It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Welcome to episode 11 of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. I am Matt Wardlaw, and here with me, as always, is my good friend, Jeff Giles. How are you doing, Jeff?
Always a pleasure to do an episode of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour with you, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. You don't mean that, but I love that. Today, we welcome to the program singer-songwriter Jay Nash, who's going to talk with us about his new record, Letters from the Lost. And I got to tell you, as a music fan, I've always felt that it's really important when you go to see live music to show up for the whole show. Go see the opening act, too. And Jay Nash is a perfect example of the reason why you should do that. First time I got to see Jay live, he was performing as part of a three-band bill that, although all three artists performed separate sets, the whole evening had sort of a Rolling Thunder review feel to it as they were on stage with each other throughout the night, contributing various instruments and vocal performances throughout each set. In this case, I went to see three artists that I had never seen before, and I really hadn't heard their music, so I walked away that night with three new favorites in my collection, the music of Greg Laswell, Jay Nash, and Anya Marina, and that right there, friends, is the power of music. Let's welcome in Jay Nash to the program. Jay, how are you doing?
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here. I'm doing well. I was sitting there listening to your description, wondering, which tour it was going to be, because I saw The Last Waltz when I was in college, I think, for the first time. Well, I really paid it. I'd seen it when I was a kid, but I really, got it and developed a philosophy for living at that point that, every night should be like The Last Waltz. So
it's a lofty goal.
A lot of tours go that route.
I was going to talk about your tour with AC/DC and Metallica, but I didn't want people to get the wrong impression.
Yeah, there are no wrong impressions. I think I would have to come armed with more than just an acoustic guitar, though, I think, if I was going to tour with those guys.
You know, that tour with Laswell, that was probably one of the best multi-artist bills I've seen, and you guys had a great chemistry there on stage. I wouldn't have been surprised to see a band come out of that tour.
Yeah, it was a fun one. We definitely had a great time and felt a lot like a band. I think that tour finished in Austin for South by Southwest, and so we had a couple opportunities over the course of the South by Southwest weekend to get up on stage in front of some bigger crowds and pretend like we were a band. Well, we had been for the 6 weeks leading up to it. I'm trying to think where did you catch a show?
I actually caught the show at the Winchester in Cleveland.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. I think that was one of the smallest, as I recall, one of the smallest shows on the tour. I like that old place, though. It used to be a bowling alley.
It's definitely a cool venue and, a good place to hear live music. And I think one of the things I dug about that tour was, I think you guys talked from the stage that, among other things, none of you apparently knew how to play bass, so you guys were all trying to learn how to play a new instrument on that tour.
Yeah, no, that's a true story. We just had I'm bringing a drummer, and Laswell said, well, I'm bringing Brandon, who plays guitar, and I was like, maybe we should just get a bass and bring it with us and one of us can play it, which since then, that seemed like a crazy idea at the time, but it worked out all right. And since then, on quite a few tours, we've done the same thing. The beginning of, I guess it was 2011, Matthew Perryman Jones and I did a tour, and we kind of had the same idea. He brought a drummer, I brought a guitar player, and we just brought a bass along with us, too, and we formed a band, and we were pretty good by the end of a couple weeks of touring. But it's a great way to do it. I think, you get the chance to sort of indulge yourself when you're writing the songs and recording the songs exactly the way you want to. I think when you go out and tour them, it should be a little bit more of a conversation, a little bit more of a collective and connective experience, not only with the audience but with the people that you're touring with. And from a standpoint of economy, it makes sense also to branch out and kind of share resources. So I think it's a model that works.
And that's where I came into your music, but it seems like, and this is just my perception, It seems like that record that you were promoting at the time, the things that you think are the things that you think the, I'm going to just butcher this.
You got it. You got it. The things you think you
need. The record you were promoting at the time, that, yeah, it seems like that was an important record for you and kind of an important period for you.
Yeah, it really was. That's definitely an astute observation. That record one was really the first full, you know, professional recording that I ever made. I'd made a bunch of records prior to that, but I always did them without anyone else's help. You know, I produced them myself and did them basically for free. You know, I think there's some good sounding records and some cool stuff that I'm still proud of, that, Some Kind of Comfort and A Stream Up North. And I think there's some strong songs on all those records, but The Things You Think You Need, I enlisted the help of producer Chris Seyfried, and he brought in Charlie Gillingham and David Emmergluck from the Counting Crows, and we got Don Heffington to play drums, who's kind of a legendary Los Angeles drummer who's, you know, been Bob Dylan's drummer for a spell, Lucinda Williams, Ricky Lee Jones, and he's just a badass motherfucker. And then and my old pal Matt Delvecchio, who I'd been playing with for years, and the record took on kind of a life of its own in the studio. Charlie and David ended up being present for almost the entire recording process, even though I'd only really hired them and paid them to be there for a couple days. You know, they were there all month, and it was like the first fully realized album. And when it came out, I think it had a bit more of an impact than my previous records in terms of finding an audience. So it kind of got me out of the trenches a little bit, you know, got me out of the open mic nights and stuff like that, and out to a little bit bigger audience.
Yeah, and it seems like you learned some interesting things promoting that record, because I remember you tell me that, you know, when you came away from promoting that record, that physical CDs represented only 5% of your sales for that record. I mean, that had to be pretty eye-opening for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, some things went right and some things went wrong with the promotion of that record. You know, we had a license deal with this little label called Bonded Records, and they were distributed through Fontana Distribution. And Fontana they were big fans and big supporters of the record, and they were prepared for it to be a great big release, you know. So they printed a lot of copies of that thing, and they had it shipped out everywhere, and they had it in the end caps. But unfortunately, the record label, you know, that little record label, kind of went belly up literally a few days before the album was to be released. So the distribution company had everything set up, geared up for this big launch, and then all of a sudden, the label's like, "Oh, sorry, we don't have the budget that we, you know, had planned on having." So, you know, there a lot of the things that could have and should have happened to promote the album didn't, right then and there. But yeah, it was the physical sales were insignificant by comparison. And from an independence perspective, it doesn't make as much sense. You know, it doesn't make sense to print that much physical product, and then the actual costs involved of shipping physical product out to all these different places, and then, you know, getting people to buy it. It's hard to make ends meet, and it's hard to have that make sense. So, you know, unless you have some partnership with Target or Starbucks or something like that. But sadly, record stores have all but disappeared. I think there's still a market that exists for stuff like vinyl and, you know, special products, but you know, the game has changed, certainly.
How do you dust yourself off and move forward after an experience like that? Because I think for a lot of artists, just the act of getting a deal, you know, that's like, that's the dream, that's the end right there, you know, that's your...
Yeah, well, it was never, I never really wanted a deal. I wanted to make records, you know. Mm-hmm. When I started playing music, you know, in earnest, it was like, all right, well, I want to make records that are going to stand the test of time. I want to say something that, you know, is my truth, at least at this point in time. And I think as I got better at telling the truth and I got better at sort of crafting original musical ideas and conveying those ideas in a live setting, that the audience grew along with it, you know, slowly but surely. And so a modest record deal came along with that. And when it didn't work, yeah, it was disappointing. But at the end of the day, I got my record back. You know, right. I owned it. I didn't owe them any money, so I could sell it at my shows and keep all the money. And my audience did grow a bit, so I was on my feet. I landed on my feet, and you know, I guess it could have gone a lot bigger, and I could have ended up maybe with certainly a larger fan base and greater notoriety. But it didn't work out so badly for me. You know, I ended up so that I could go around a lot of places around the country and play a show and make a living from it, which to me that's kind of the dream, is being able to do what you love to do. You know, that's a real, I think that I consider that to be a real blessing.
You also have to, you find yourself in the position of having to learn the business side kind of on the fly, though, as you're refining your craft as a songwriter, though.
Certainly. It's, you know, it's changed immensely, and it's changed even since then, since, you know, yeah. It's changed since 2010,
right,
when I made Diamonds and Blood. There's all these other things, like those, for a long time, you know, digital royalties were paying the bills for a lot of independent artists, and then Spotify came along and cut those digital royalties in half.
Yeah.
So you got to find all these different ways. You know, people are crowdsourcing the funding for their albums. Now there's something called Stage It, where you can put on a show and webcast, and people can buy tickets to see the show online, which, you know, it's a great idea, as it turns out. I had no idea. I did one last week, and I was, you know, blown away by the attendance and, you know, people's enthusiasm for it. You know, I think vinyl's coming back. There's a million different ways to skin a cat, and I've been saying this for years, like, the music industry is the Wild West, and you could look at it, you could be negative about it and say, oh, well, it's a bummer, all I want to do is make music. Of course, that's all anyone wants to do. But, you know, any wild success story, like from Madonna to Katy Perry, I don't know, anybody who's probably even just somebody like Justin Timberlake, obviously those are vastly different entities from the people that I grew up listening to, like The Band and Bob Dylan, who probably were artists in the pure sense. But I think long-term sustainable success in music requires kind of an interdisciplinary approach to your life and your career. You got to be able to do different things. And I think in the end, for me at least, it helps the art to have some distractions from it, rather than sitting there, you know, with a guitar in my hand, banging my head against the wall, trying to write a song every minute of every day. Doing some different stuff it's cool. It's you know, it stimulates the brain. You're learning, you keep it moving, and you have a reason to take a step away from the art in its purest sense, so that when you do come back to it, it's fresh and it's exciting, you know.
That's a great way to look at it.
You know, talking about the system, you seem like somebody that creatively, at least one part of the system that works really well for you is just the fact that, like, so many artists these days are, you know, putting out music themselves digitally, whether it's Bandcamp or whatever it is. You seem like you've been able to use that to your advantage to kind of be able to put stuff out when you want to. And it seems like if you were constrained to, like, only doing one album, you know, every, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 years, it seems like you might be, you know, stifled a little bit in that kind of system.
Well, yes and no. I think it's my creativity is kind of commensurate with my success or lack thereof. You know, you put a record out, and if it's a big hit, you're going to tour the world, and you know, you want to take the point of making the music is to connect with the people who want to hear it. And you know, the 2 to 4 year record cycle, well, the 2 year record cycle, let's say, kind of corresponds with, that's how long it takes to make the big lap, which is cool. But I think if you ask any artist who makes an artist and does and makes a record and does that, by the time they're getting finished with that lap, they're ready to play some new songs. They're ready to like reinvent themselves musically or creatively and move forward. So in my case, I make a record and I go out and play it for the people who want to hear it. And it takes about 9 to 12 months for me to be okay. I'm ready to start anew, and you know, I've got something else to say. But I think that it's a fine line between putting out too much and speaking when you don't have anything to say, or saying the same thing over and over again.
That touches on something I wanted to ask you about. I just read an interview you did last year where you talked about going through a 2-year spell where you didn't write at all.
Yeah, and that was a lot of that was 2008 and 2009. I was just busy. Mm-hmm. You know, the things you think you need actually it created a new, you know, for me and. For me, it was significant. For other artists, it probably wouldn't be as significant. But there were a lot of opportunities to play that music in a lot of different places. And stuff kept on coming up, and I didn't really have the time to take a step back. I was sort of taking it. I was taking it all in, but the experiences didn't connect for me to. Put it all together and sort of synthesize a new idea of reflection upon what was happening.
So here's a question that relates to that. I know that for a lot of creative people, when you get your first taste of success, a lot of that, it often comes with a feeling of that you're almost sort of a fraud and that people are just a couple steps away from figuring out that you don't really have the talent that they think you have. And if you get that first taste, and then it's followed by a period where it's hard for you to write. Does that weigh on you at all? I mean, did that worry?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that's there's the anxiety is like, oh, it's over. I'm like, the well is dry. If you ask me now, having gone through that and come out the other side of it, the lesson that I've learned is you don't, it's like. Not to quote the Beatles, but you can't hurry. You can't hurry love, and you can't hurry writing songs. They're going to come when they're going to come. The magic is going to happen, you know, when it's going to happen, whether it's convenient or not. And that's just the way it goes. It can make you feel anxious when, I would think if you're in a situation where you have a record label saying, we need a hit,
right.
That could be really frustrating and stressful. I don't feel like it really got to that point with me. You know, I was feeling like, I didn't really feel like I had songs to write on my own. So I started collaborating and I did a whole bunch of co-writes with a lot of different people, and that kept me sort of, stimulated creatively. But you know, I have a very reasonable approach. I think to art and music, and I had this diversion from my musical life. I played music all throughout high school and then after college, but my college years I was an engineering student, and the whole idea of engineering is problem solving, and so I kind of approach everything in my life as like, oh, there is a solution, you just have to find it, you know.
Right.
If this set of variables doesn't work, try something else. And that's kind of how I approach it. But sure, I think the archetype of the music industry, when it rose to prominence, put an incredible amount of pressure on musicians because it was based on commerce. And the cool thing about the way it works now and the new kind of independent structure is, you know, there's, like I said before, there's a million different ways to do it. You know, and it like the solution that works today isn't necessarily going to work tomorrow. And rather than being daunted by that or discouraged by that, I think you should use that as a source of inspiration. That everything Everything is kind of temporary, so why not try it? You know, it's kind of like that's how we got into music in the first place, is because we wanted to be creative. We wanted to create something that wasn't there before. So, you know, we have the opportunity now to try anything. You know, whether it's a collaboration with a different artist, or you know, playing a different instrument, or exploring a different genre of music, or you know, combining different musical textures to create something new. I think that's kind of fun. Or selling, you know, coming up with a product or a package that has never been made available to audiences before. I think all that stuff is pretty fun and exciting. And a nice diversion from when you're feeling that those moments of divine inspiration, awesome. If you're not, there's plenty of stuff you can do.
I totally agree. And you know, as a fan, I want to look at the last couple records that you've done, and I think Diamonds and Blood was an interesting album following Things You Think You Need, and I think that this new album is a really interesting record on the heels of Diamonds and Blood. Can you kind of talk about, you know, where your head was at with each one of those records?
Well, Things You Think You Need kind of tells is more of a personal narrative. As is Diamonds and Blood is kind of chapter two to Things You Think You Need. To give you a vague general answer, you know, the Things You Think You Need is kind of the struggles that you go through, or that I went through in order to differentiate what I wanted and what was ultimately truly important to me. And Diamonds and Blood is kind of having found that, sort of the virtues of something that is, you know, really built to stand the test of time. Letters from the Lost really differs greatly, I think, from both of those records, because I didn't set out trying to tell a specific story, and I hadn't accumulated any songs along the way that I was like, oh, well, this song is going to be on the record, or this song is going to be on the record. Letters from the Lost, I started from scratch. The writing and recording process started at the same time, which is a lot, is very similar actually to Stream Up North. Different concept, but a Stream Up North, with, you know, the writing and recording process was combined as well. So with this record, I didn't have a concept for what I was going to write the record about. And I didn't realize there was a concept until the record was mixed and mastered and delivered. So it was very unusual for me. I started with the music. I started with most of the time I would start with some element aside from my voice, you know, say like a bass line or a riff on an instrument, a guitar or a mandolin, sometimes a drum beat or a loop. I would start with a simple melodic and rhythmic element, and I would start building the song. I'd track that and then record it, or maybe I'd loop it and then I'd put another layer on it, and then I'd start singing to a real bare bones skeleton of a song, frame of a song, and I would start singing, you know, nonsensical sounds, nonsensical words, phonetic sounds, with melodies, and then I'd continue building the track. And so, and the other thing is, I had to give myself a day to complete the process on an entire song, you know, with kind of the philosophy that it was going to either happen or it wasn't. Not to say that I've had some success with songs where I've written them over an extended period of time, but I was like, I needed an exercise, because I hadn't really had the chance to stop and focus and write in a long while, and I wanted to try something new. This concept actually applied to the songs that are on Of the Woods, the EP that put out last spring. So each day I would start with this loop, and I'd start with this process, and I'd give myself until the end of the day to write and record a song, you know, a demo of a song. And as the song came together, musically and harmonically in some cases, I would wait and try to figure out what story the melody and rhythms were trying to tell. And that's when I would start writing lyrics. And believe it or not, over the course of a day, the lyrics and the stories would kind of reveal themselves to me in a very subconscious way. You know, there was no preconceived thought like, okay, I'm going to write a song about this. All of the lyrics, all of the rhymes, all of the concepts kind of presented themselves to me from the music, which was really fun, and I thought really kind of, pardon the use of the phrase or term, mystical, just because it was so the opposite of my conscious approach to writing songs in the past, which had been, this happened to me and I want to write a song about it, or wouldn't it be cool if I told this story? You know, this wasn't any of that. I didn't have any idea for the stories that I was going to tell until after the songs started to take shape. In some cases, they ended up being specific things. Like I started, like for instance, The Art Thief. I had the chorus I'd come up with, you know, you can blame me if you want. And then I sort of stumbled across, that was the chorus that I was working with. And then I stumbled across the story about that guy, Mark Lugo, who stole the Picasso painting off the wall at the gallery in San Francisco. Like he came up in a taxi cab, had the taxi driver wait for him, went upstairs, took the painting, just took it off the shelf or off the wall, and then just walked out of there like everything was totally normal, got in the cab, and had the cab driver take him to Napa Valley, where he went and had like a fancy dinner. And he had no idea. He couldn't really understand why he was being prosecuted, because he felt like, you know, who does art really belong to? But I'd heard that story like a couple days before, I guess. And then when I started singing this chorus, I was like, oh, it's about that. And then the lyrics wrote themselves very quickly. And so once the record was done, I realized, oh, wow, these are all kind of stories about people that are lost or have been lost, or I've had some sort of loose encounter with, or in a few cases, I guess the state of being being a little bit disconnected and sort of finding your way back. So it is different.
I think this would be a good spot to stick in a song.
Okay.
Is there a particular one you'd like to play?
I'll play the first track on the record, which is Wander. I'll have to get the baritone plugged in. On the record, it's kind of, it really weighs heavily on a lot of kind of psychedelic components and elements. A loop that Bill Leffler and I kind of built up from snapping our fingers and pounding on things, and then some guitar parts where I had the luxury of being able to just turn everything all the way up and freak out, making sounds that would have terrified the neighbors if I had any. All right, so yeah, this is the very first track on the new record. And it employs the use of a baritone guitar that I got at a little shop in Hanover, New Hampshire, tax-free. So I'll try this. Thank you.
First song I heard off the record, and that's got such a spooky vibe to it that I could not wait to hear the rest of the record. And there's a lot of interesting atmosphere on
Definitely.
This record in the sounds.
Well, thank you, and I have to give credit where credit is due. A lot of that is I have to give props to Ben Peeler, who's just a great guitar player. You know, who's played on. You look him up. I think he's played a lot of. He used to play on a lot of Beck's records, and he's really active in the Los Angeles scene. But we didn't really know. We figured we'd just let him do what he was going to do, and he played played lap steel through a bunch of pedals, and this delay thing with lap steel that was really cool, and ended up being this sound that we threaded through a lot of the record, which is like. You know, and it ends up being that kind of high pitch sustained thing that you probably like, oh, what is that? So that ended up, it's a subtle thing, but it's there on a lot of the tracks. And then I guess the other element is like, this is the first record in a while where I played a lot of guitar. You know, when David Immergluck is in the room, I'm just like, dude, play, go, do whatever you're going to do. Prior to Things You Think You Need, I had played most of the lead parts myself, and sort of having a home studio to experiment and get back into the joy of guitar, I did that, and so I ended up playing a lot of guitar myself, and you know, had the luxury of not being on the clock, you know, as far as studio time, so I could try out a bunch of different things and just see, you know, chase weird down the wormhole and just find out what would happen if I tried this guitar into this amp, or you know, this combination of pedals, or just try a riff that I'd never played before, just going for it. And you know, that's kind of the sound, like at the end of the second half of Wander, there's a guitar part that comes in that's, you know, it almost sounds like it's backwards. It's not, it's just I'm sort of playing odd phrasing, but it was a lot of fun to do for me. It was kind of like kid in the candy store kind of moment to to be able to do that stuff.
You were talking about being on the clock, and I wanted to thank you real quick for keeping the record under 35 minutes. Not very many people do that these days, and it left me wanting more. It's a really, it's a nice length for the record. It tells a story, it says what it has to say, and then it's done, and then you want to hear it again.
Oh, thanks. I have a hard time going over 34 minutes on one record. I think that's just where my attention span is. I forget exactly what, you know, the previous two full lengths are, but they probably clock in pretty close to that. I just look at most of, you know, my favorite records that I listen to over and over, and they're rarely more than 10 songs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But these days, you know,
like
see
Damn
15,
the Torpedoes
songs,
or Born to Run. Yeah, but thanks for noticing.
The first time I heard it,
I'm glad
I was listening to it and it ended, and I thought, wait, is that it really? And I looked up, and you know,
yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't know why it happened. It doesn't really make sense. It doesn't really make sense business wise why people started making like 13, 14 song records, and I don't fully get it creatively, you know. It's like, how, if it's really truly an album where it's a collection of songs and kind of a meditation on a concept and, you know, a moment in time, how much can you possibly have to say that's truly interesting about mm-hmm. that one thing? I'm sure there's exceptions to the rule, and there's some great, I think, double records. I think the double record's kind of a different thing, though.
Right.
And I think also it's different if it's a full band, you know, where it's not just about the vocal performance and the stories. It's about the you know, the conversation between the different instruments. I think that affords more time to stretch out and keep it interesting. But singer songwriter albums that run longer than 34 minutes, I'm somewhat dubious of.
Yeah, there's some interesting conversations happening on this record. You know, player wise, you know, besides Ben, you know, who's playing with you on this record and who's singing with you on this record?
The rhythm section in most cases is kind of a construction. The drums are kind of a construction by the co-producer, Bill Leffler, in most cases, where we kind of build. He has an interesting approach to recording drums. He kind of records each part individually. You know, which sounds weird at first, but you find the perfect place for each rhythmic component. And he also does it after the vocals are recorded. So it's never, you might notice there's never any kind of rub between the drums and the vocals. It's a different, there's a lot of space afforded to the vocal by the drums. And on all but two tracks, Johnny Flower played the last two tracks. I played bass, or actually, I'm sorry, I Won't Let Go and Blame It All in the Wind. I played bass, but Johnny Flower played bass on the rest of it. He's great. He just lays it down. I think he's as good as it gets. And then, like I was saying, the steel parts, the steel guitar parts are Ben Peeler. Ben Peeler also played the mandola solo on Art Thief, and Kyler England sings harmony vocals on Sometimes and Sailor, and then the rest of the record is me. So
nice.
And I think actually Bill played a little bit of piano on a couple tracks, but yeah, the rest of it is I guess I played bass on Stars as well. I'm not really a bass player, but I, you know, enough to get. I learned what I know from that Laswell tour in 2009. And, you know, I guess enough to get by, but you know, it was fun because I got to play a lot of mandolin and guitar, and I grew up on the Grateful Dead, so I'm kind of obsessed with like the interplay between multiple guitars, and that's a lot of fun for me to kind of come up with. And I'm also a freak about sounds and tone and tube amps and stuff and microphones and preamps, so I had a real chance to geek out in the studio and, you know, create what I thought were the perfect guitar tones.
But, and that's one thing we were talking about was, you know, just what a huge sounding record this is. But the other thing, and you mentioned Wonder, which is really a great jumping off point. It happens to be the lead track of the record, but it's also the, you know, first song that I heard. And I just was sitting there going, you know, I haven't heard sounds like this on a Jay Nash record before. And listening to this entire record, I actually spent quite a bit of time listening to this new record on headphones because it seemed ask for that. Is that a part of the listening process that you think about at all when you're recording?
Oh, sure. I mean, I one of the things that motivated me to want to make music were records that I listened to over and over on headphones. So I think every record I make, I really am striving towards that, and, you know, trying to create the stereo separation and kind of an immersive listening experience. So thank you. I really appreciate that you took the time to do that. That means, that really does mean a lot. I think that's a huge part of it for sure, is trying to create a conversation, you know, between both ears. It's no coincidence that that's kind of the first track that you heard, and I felt like that sort of personifies the shift, you know, the creative shift of this record, where it's kind of a meditative, the song is kind of a meditation in and of itself, and you know, a deviation harmonically and melodically from a lot of stuff I've done in the past. And my previous records have been about the sound of a band in a room, you know, a band's interpretation of my songs. And these songs are kind of constructions in and of themselves, where I've kind of calculated every component. It's a little bit more of a lab project than previous outings.
Definitely sounds like that. Could we get you to play another tune?
Yeah. Let's see. You know, maybe I'll do the bookends, and I'll play the last track on the record, which is called "Blame It All on the Wind," which almost ended up being the name of this record. I screwed up already.
Come around when everything is wrong. Leave me wondering what could have brought you here. With an emptiness inside, as you're screaming at the sky, wondering when your prayers might finally be heard. If there's no whispering of truth somewhere down deep inside of you, blame it all on wind. You should go. Blame it all on wind. Now all the lines are down. There's no one left in town. So you finally got some time to be alone. Space to think, darling, we're on the brink of war again. You don't care which way we go. If there's no whispering of truth somewhere down deep inside of you, blame it all. Go, blame it all on me. Mm-hmm. old house is falling down. I'm picking pieces off the ground. It's falling faster than I can turn around. This old world is just the same. We try to figure who to blame, but the truth is we should look inside ourselves. If there's no whispering of truth somewhere down deep inside of you, blame it all on the wind. You should go, blame it all on the wind. You should go.
Listening to this record, you know, hearing like the transition, the segue between The Art Thief and Sometimes, is that indicative of how that went in the recording process, or is that something that started to come together when you got into sequencing?
We tracked the guitar, actually, the steel guitar, the thing that I was, the Ben Peeler steel guitar thing, I think back to back on those two tracks. And yeah. After I was listening to mixes, I was like, oh, this could work. Like, I could sort of create this sort of crossfade thing and stay in the dream, you know, not break the spell between the two songs. But, you know, we did the basic tracking for the songs or for the entire album in a relatively short period of time. And I think it was 4 days. And that included most of the lead vocals, and then I took stuff home and did what I was going to do to them in terms of adding additional guitars and, you know, harmony vocals and stuff. But that transition, the sequence of the album took a little bit of calculation to kind of figure out what made sense. You know, I didn't even realize until the thing was completed and mastered what the whole thing was about. It was such a sort of subconscious experience.
Well, I want to move towards wrapping up here. I guess I'll ask you, number one, when can folks get their hands on this record officially? I know it's slated for April sometime.
No, actually May. Our tentative release date at this point is May 14th.
What's the plan from that point after this thing is up and out? I know obviously you're going to, you know, do some big showcase stuff down at South by Southwest, but, you know, touring wise, do you have anything particular in mind as far as, you know, who you might go out with or, you know,
I'm not going to mention any names just yet, but the hope is for mostly in the spring I'll be supporting some larger acts, and then I'm going to do some headline shows in kind of my major markets like New York and Chicago, Philly, Boston. And then in the fall, what I'm hoping to do is actually build something similar to, you know, kind of a Rolling Thunder concept of three or four artists sharing one band, and really make a show that's kind of an unforgettable experience that combines everything from the, you know, the most quiet, intimate singer-songwriter moments to full-on psychedelic rock. we're kind of hammering out that stuff now, but I should be everywhere by the end of the year. I should get everywhere from Boston to San Diego and most places in between, including Ohio.
You know, I want to wrap up with a question, and I want to ask about the stuff that you've done in the past few years with the TFDI project. as a result of playing with Tony, obviously, I mean, that was a collaborative thing between all of you, but in the midst of that, the stuff developed with him going on The Voice. Mm-hmm. What sort of perspective did that give you as an artist watching him go through that?
Well, the same time they asked me to do it as well. And I, you know, Tony jumped into it head first, and I was like, okay, you're going to do it. All right. Well, you got to win. If you're going to do this thing, you have to win. I think he was coming at it with from a slightly different set of circumstances than, you know, if I had done it, it would have been a little bit, I think that my fan base would think it was a little bit more bizarre, and out of context than his, given just that he kind of came from the, you know, the Mickey Mouse Club background and stuff. I don't know. Those shows, to be honest, I can't stand them. You know, it was fun to watch. It was really a lot of fun to watch Tony play, Tony on it, and Tony do really well and step up and kind of really establish himself. But those settings are so, to me, it's the opposite of music. And the thing that drives people to winning performances on them is not inspiration. It's like self-involvement, and it's this desire to win. And that's, to me, that's the antithesis of the spirit of music. Music is to connect, and it's not a competition. It's completely a subjective thing. So, you know, if I want to compete with somebody, I will race them on skis, or I'll arm wrestle them, you know, or, you know, we can play a game of Scrabble. But music to me is the opposite of competition. So I think that the whole phenomenon is kind of sickening. I was really happy to see Tony do well on it, and I was rooting for him every step of the way. And, you know, also hoping that it didn't have a net negative effect on his, you know, existing fan base that had been kind of built brick by brick, or, a net negative effect on his take home, you know, for having larger corporate entities involved in his business. So far, I think it seems like it's worked out all right. I think his audience has grown, and he's really enjoyed working with Adam. And I think it's been an overall good thing for him.
I think you put the finger on what's wrong with reality singing competitions pretty perfectly.
Well, it's kind of become a significant chunk of what the music industry is, and you know how people rise to prominence, and I think it stifled some real creativity, but at the same time, maybe it's inspired a little bit of a backlash. You know, there's no shortage of great music out there right now, or no shortage of great music that's being made. Unfortunately, not everybody's hearing it, and unfortunately, the airwaves are choked with, you know, some of the manufactured crap that's sort of drizzling out of the, you know, the competition shows and the winners of these competition shows. And it's not to say that the winners couldn't be great artists, and many of them are. I mean, right. Kelly Clarkson the other night, I mean, or Carrie Underwood, these girls can sing, you know, they're amazing. And, you know,
that's true. I just think it often,
there are some positive elements, but
it often confuses people about what the real reasons for making music should be.
Yeah. Exactly. It's true. But I don't know. I think anytime a great song or a great artist gets heard, it's a good thing no matter what. But that kind of ends up in being, you look much deeper than that at these award these competition shows. It ends up being kind of a battle of philosophy. And I don't know. I think I'd be kind of arrogant if I professed to have all the answers about it. So, only opinions.
Well, I think we want to go ahead and wrap up here, man. If we could have you wrap up with a song, I think Jeff would like to hear "Hard Lesson," if that's one you can do.
Yeah, I can do that. Totally.
Cool.
Yeah, I can do that. Well, thanks, guys. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate all the time you've given listening to my songs. It means a lot. It sounds like you guys are exactly the kind of guys that I'm making music for, and that make it worthwhile. So thank you so much.
All right, this tune, as anybody who's ever been to one of my live shows may recall, is a song about a fist fight at a burrito stand from Things You Think You Need. It's called Hard Lesson. I should warn, it was never written with the intention of being played before nightfall, and it is before noon.
Yeah, man, you look so far down. Are you tired of singing about this broken town? Well, I know she left about a week ago. The tears aren't dry. You pretend to know and you say, I don't think it's me. It's a hard lesson to learn. Not me. Oh, it had to be you. Hard lesson to learn. Take a walk down the boulevard. We'll find comfort there underneath the stars. He pushed so hard and you got nothing back. It hurts like hell, like a heart attack. And I wish that I could tell you the truth. It's a hard lesson to learn. Not me. Oh, it had to be you. Hard lesson to learn. There's a darkness in the heart of man. You never know that it's there till you find out where you stand. Then you live a hard lesson to learn. And his eyes, stroke of fear was that I couldn't recognize. I didn't know I hit him. I didn't know I could. Look back, I guess I hit him harder than I should. Now he is gone by. The truth is out, you know who he is. You learn to live without, and the scars will heal. You forget them all. Sometimes you fight to break your fall. A hard lesson to learn.